It's good to have all of you. And those of you that are joining us on Zoom, we're glad that you're interested in what we're trying to do and interested in the Bible studies that we are engaged in. We're studying this evening from Luke, the 13th chapter. Now, some of the things that we have to say about the 13th chapter will be in short order because we've looked at some of these things before. Actually, the context begins in verse 22, we're not going to go back up and not even review that because we've gone through that two or three times, I think, already. But I want to pick up our reading in verse 31. We just barely introduced this point, I think, last time, and I want to cover it just a little bit better and then get on into the 14th chapter. But in the 13th chapter, beginning in verse 31 through verse 35, it says, "In that very hour, there came certain Pharisees saying to him, Get thee out and go hence, for Herod would fain kill thee. And he said unto them, Go and say to that fox, Behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow and the third day I am perfected. Nevertheless, I must go on my way today and tomorrow and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets and stoneth them that are sent unto her, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her own brood under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate, and I say unto you, ye shall not see me until ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." Now there are a number of things in this brief passage of Scripture that I want to note with you. One is that Herod had long desired to see Jesus. Now, remind me, we did not talk about that last time, did we? I didn't think so. Herod had long desired to see Jesus. He had more of an interest, curiosity, I suppose, than perhaps anything else. But if you'll note in Luke, the 9th chapter, backing up in this book just a little bit, Luke, the 9th chapter, reading beginning in verse 7, it says, "And Herod the Tetrarch heard of all that was done, and he was much perplexed, because that it was said by some that John was risen from the dead, and by some that Elijah had appeared, and by others that one of the old prophets was risen. And Herod said, John I beheaded, but who is this, about whom I hear such things? And he sought to see him." Now that is quite informative. It helps us to see that Herod just had a great curiosity about Jesus. Based on what some were saying, he wanted to see this man. He wanted to see what he was doing, perhaps even to see a miracle. And as you go beyond this chapter that we're studying, Luke 13 in the Gospel of Luke, if you'll turn over to the 23rd chapter of Luke and pick it up beginning at verse 7, chapter 23, verse 7, there it says, "And when he knew that he was of Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him," this is Pilate now, "sent him unto Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem in these days." Now we note that Herod, again, he wanted to see Jesus do something. Look at verse 15. It says, "No, nor yet Herod, for he sent him back unto us, and behold, nothing worthy of death hath been done by him. Therefore, I released him, I chastised him and released him." And so this is what Pilate has to say. But what we want to note in this, you'll see again in Matthew the 14th chapter, verse 1, just the curiosity of Herod, wanting to see something done that he had heard perhaps about Jesus. But note the warning of these Jews to Jesus is that you better get out of here because Herod, he'll kill you. Now Herod did have the authority to do that. But the problem here was that really was never Herod's intent. He didn't set out a search party to find out who Jesus was so that he could kill him. Now we know that these Pharisees that we're reading about here, why is it that they're engaging with Jesus to begin with? What was typical of the engagements of the Pharisees with Jesus? What do we see in the previous verses about their engagement? Yes, Randy?
The tested him and tried to trick him into saying something.
Yeah, this was just par for the course. This is what they wanted to do. And if they can intimidate Jesus by saying, you better get, Herod's wanting to kill you. Well, let me ask you, Randy, being as you volunteered that, if you knew that somebody was trying to kill you, that they had a plot in place and that they were sending out a search party trying to find you so that they could kill you, would you word your response as Jesus said here? You tell that old fox that I cast out demons and I perform cures today and tomorrow and the third day I am perfect. You go tell that old fox I'm not coming.
No, because whoever told it would also include the foxes.
Yeah, he'd probably include that in his report, and that wouldn't make you very many brownie points for the fellow that's trying to kill you. So our point is, Herod was not trying to kill Jesus. This is a false charge. He may have had some authority to try to do that, but that was not his intent. His was more curiosity. He'd heard the things that Jesus was doing that Jesus identifies here. I cast out demons. I perform cures. And the third day, I'm perfected. Now, talk to me about being perfected. Is Jesus identifying 3 days sequence of time here from the time that he's talking with these folks? No, what is he talking about?
All right.
He's talking about his death, his resurrection, his perfection as he would have finished the course of the work that he was to do. Now, you go tell that old fox that that's the way that it is. Now, I wanted to note with you just a little bit. I'm going to jump ahead, and then I'm going to come back. Because I want to notice the things on this chart. I have it actually in not the best order. But I want to note that Jesus has referred to these Pharisees numerous times in headbutting with them. And look at the terms that he's used to identify them. He's called them hypocrites. He's called them blind guides. He's called them fools. He's called them whited sepulchers within or dead men's bones. He's called them serpents. And he's called them a generation of vipers. And now he tells this crowd, you go tell that old fox that I'm not going anywhere. Does it sound like that Jesus is afraid of their intimidation? Well, not hardly. No, not hardly. Not hardly. Now, I said, I think last week, that I wanted to comment on this expression, the old fox. But as we look at that expression, who Herod was is critical for us to understand for a couple of reasons. One is, you'll note that Herod's father was Idumean. That is, he was an Edomite. His mother was a Samaritan. Now, what's the significance of that as far as the Jews are concerned? I didn't hear somebody. Well, that's true. You know, when we consider the Edomites, who did they descend from? Esau. And the Jews, of course, descended from Jacob. And so you've got this between the Jews and the Edomites. And this is where Herod came from as far as his father is concerned. Now, his mother was a Samaritan. What's the significance of that to the Jews? Well, you've got this same thing. Jews have no dealings with Samaritans, and we see that in John chapter 4 with the Samaritan woman and her conversation with the Lord. Now, old Herod, if you've studied anything about him, you know he was not a very nice guy, right? Well, we know that Herod had... Go ahead, Randy.
You know which Herod this is?
But I can't recall right away. I think it's Herod Agrippa the First, if I recall. I think Herod Agrippa the Second is the one that Paul was before in Acts chapter 26. But some of you who have readily accessible information there, you may want to check that. But I believe this is Herod Agrippa the First. I may be mistaken about that. But none of the Herod family. We've done that series of studies on the Herods. In our history and geography, and we've noted that none of the Herods were good, honorable people. Now, if this is the Herod that I think it is, and I'm thinking that I'm right on this, this is the Herod that had married his brother Philip's wife. Now, when you consider who this man is, as far as his heritage is concerned, and his relationship to the Jews, he's an Idumean, an Edomite. He's mixed with the Samaritan people, and both of those lines of the family tree were hated by the Jews, just despised by the Jews. But now here is old Herod. He's just wicked to the core. But what's his job as governor?
Keep the peace.
Keep the peace with the Jews.
I want to suggest this to you, that from what we know about Herod, he's walking the razor's edge. He's just walking a tightrope. And when Jesus said, "You go tell that old fox," there was a reason why old Herod had to be so crafty. If he slipped just a little bit, he's in trouble with the Jews, he's in trouble with the Samaritans, he's in trouble with the Edomites. And so he had to walk that tightrope to just stay where he was supposed to be. And that's one of the things that you see regarding the crucifixion of Jesus. When Pilate wanted to crucify Jesus, he wanted to run that by Herod. Why? He wanted to maintain a good political relationship. And we think that politics is all new. No, politics has been around a long, long time. And that's what we're seeing here with Herod, and he's referred to as an old fox. Now, sometimes, the second point that I want you to see is sometimes when we study the issue of marriage, divorce, and remarriage, the study of Herod comes up, and rightly so, it ought to. And we note that he had taken his brother Philip's wife, and we can read about that in Matthew 14, Mark chapter 6. And the point being, in that some say, well, what Herod did was he was guilty of the sin of incest, taking his brother Philip's wife. And the sin of incest was condemned in the law of Moses. So what got Herod, or what got John in trouble, is he condemned Herod because he had violated the law of Moses. I want to suggest to you that's not so at all. That's just not so at all. It wasn't the law of Moses that Herod had violated. Herod had violated God's law from the very beginning of the marriage relationship in Genesis 2. Now, somebody said, well, he took his brother Philip's wife. That's what John said was unlawful. My response to that is very simple. Would it have been lawful if he had taken your wife? Well, no. You see, it's not because it was incest. Yeah, that's wrong, but that's not the reason why it was wrong.
You keep using the word incest. Incest is having sexual relations with a direct relative of yours.
Well, let's turn back to the text. Go back to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 20. What would you call it if he took his brother's wife? Well, it would be adultery. But the passage that I'm looking for identifies that as being contrary to the law of Moses. Whatever you call it, I think it's beside the point. I got into this discussion back years ago with Cornelius, in the household of Cornelius, and the Holy Spirit came upon the household of Cornelius, and some wanted to debate whether it was called the baptism of the Holy Spirit or whether it was not, whether it was the thing that the apostles received in Acts 2 or not. And I'm not just introducing another issue, but the debate became about what you're going to call it. What we know is John said it's unlawful. I'll have to find the passage. I thought it was Deuteronomy 23, but I'm not seeing it readily.
Well, I believe that, but the fact of the matter is that incest to sexual relations with your mother or your daughter or somebody that's directly related to you by blood.
All right, here's the passage. It's 25, Deuteronomy 25, what was condemned in the law. It says, if brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. Let me read on, verse 7. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then the brother's wife shall go up. That's not the passage I'm looking for.
That actually
yeah.
knows.
Well, after he's dead. Right. Yeah, after he's dead, but not while he's living.
That's the exact same relationship, but it's okay in that.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we see argued in Matthew 22 by the Sadducees who did not believe in the resurrection. They're talking about a dead man and so forth.
You think that some have
yeah.
said.
Some have made the argument that, right, yeah. Some have tried to make the argument that what was wrong with Herod taking Philip's wife was he has taken his brother's wife. They've used the word incest in their argument. Whether it was incest, I don't care what you call it. But that was not the point that was wrong. The relationship between Herod or Philip and Herodias was not the sin. The relationship between Herod and Herodias was what was sinful. He had somebody that he ought not be married to. Now that's the point that I want to leave with you. And if we can get that, then we've got the point that's made here. And as we're discussing the Herods, we see the kind of life that Herod and Herodias had lived. And the point being established, Herod was not a good guy.
And this threat is an idle threat. Herod's wanting to kill you. No, that's not the point. You go tell that old fox that I don't care what he's trying to do. It's not going to affect what I'm doing. And so therein lies the point. All right, any other comments or questions on that? I said I had a couple of charts previous to this. I'd like to go back to them and get that. These two charts previous to that. In verse 38 of Luke chapter 13, I'm sorry, verse 35 is where I want to be. Well, 34 beginning, I guess we'll get it. It says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets and stoneth them that are sent unto her, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her own brood under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate, and I say unto you, ye shall not see me until ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Now, I want to concentrate on this for just a moment. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets. Does this passage sound at all familiar to you? It ought to. We're studying in Luke some things that occur, in the neighborhood of about 6 months or so before Jesus is crucified. But you'll note these statements that are made are parallel to statements that Jesus made just as he came into the city, or shortly thereafter, into the city, right prior to his crucifixion. In Matthew chapter 23, we know he came into the city of Jerusalem for the last time in Matthew 21. And in Matthew 23, you'll note in verse 32, Jesus said, Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers. Ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers, how shall ye escape the judgment of hell? Therefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them shall kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of Abel the righteous unto the blood of Zechariah the son of Barachiah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets and stoneth them that are sent unto her, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Now what I want you to see is that in Matthew chapter 23, this is somewhat down the timeline from where we're studying in Luke chapter 13. So, Jesus has told them, your house is left unto you desolate. Now, early in the ministry of Jesus, you'll recall that Jesus threw the money changers out of the house of God. Does that ring a bell to you as well? You remember what he said to them about the house of God? Whose house was it? My Father's house. Now in in Matthew 23 and in Luke 13, whose house is it? It's your house. I would suggest to you that from this point forward, it was no longer the Lord's house. It was no longer the Father's house. They've turned it into their own. It's simply to serve and worship themselves. And Jesus points that out, I'm convinced, right here in our text of Luke chapter 23, or chapter 13, and in Matthew chapter 23. Now, he rebukes them for that. He points out, I would have gathered you together as a hen brings her chicks under her wings. But the problem is not what I would do. The problem is what you have done. And so be that as it may. The house of God is now a house of desolation. It's to be destroyed because it's not God's anymore. Now, I want to suggest to you, brethren, that we can look at the Lord's church. And in our study of the book of Revelation, I don't know a better place to make the point. Listen carefully. It's not the Lord's church because you can read on a sign out in front of the building, Church of Christ. It's not the Lord's church because you say, well, the Lord's church meets here. What identifies the Lord's church?
Obedience.
Yeah, its qualities or its characteristics. Just having the temple in the city of Jerusalem, having priests that go in there and wear the priestly garments and do the sacrificing, did that make it the Lord's house? No, it didn't. No, it sure didn't. And so Jesus is telling them this thing's going to fall. And you certainly see in Matthew 23 and on into Matthew 24 that the city of Jerusalem would fall. The temple would be destroyed. And it would be destroyed by the Romans. Now, brethren, listen carefully.
Just because we call ourselves the Lord's church, or church of Christ, or church of God, or assembly of God, these are scriptural designations. But these scriptural designations can be unscripturally applied when the people no longer have the qualities and characteristics that God expects of His people. Now that's important for us to see that. Do we get that? We've got to maintain these qualities or these characteristics, or we're no longer the Lord's people. He'll be with us as long as we do the things that are right. But when we stop doing, what happens to our relationship, our fellowship with Him? It's gone. Now, brethren, we need to take that home with us. And that's what Jesus is telling these people. It's not the Lord's house anymore. It's yours, and it's left to you desolate. Now, I think we've got everything that's on that chart. I want to go on, unless you've got a question or a comment, on into the 14th chapter. In the 14th chapter, let's begin reading in verse 1. And it came to pass, when he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees on the Sabbath to eat bread, that they were watching him. And behold, there was before him a certain man that had the dropsy. And Jesus answering spake unto the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? But they held their peace. And he took him and healed him and let him go. And he said unto them, Which of you shall have an ass or an ox fallen into a well, and will not straightway draw him up on a Sabbath day? And they could not answer again unto these things. Several things in there that I want to talk with you about. Have the passages on the board and some things that I want to say about it. But you'll note that it came to pass when he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees. Here's a very important fellow. And it wasn't uncommon for them to have huge feasts on the Sabbath day. But the problem here is they had evidently invited Jesus to come to this feast. The text simply states as a fact that they were watching him. I might raise to you the question just to speculate a little bit. Do you suppose that's why they wanted him there? Now, I know that the supposing is maybe something we need to be certainly careful of. But when you establish a pattern of behavior on behalf of a group of people, I think you've established something that it's worthy of notice. We need to see this. First of all, I want you to notice that in Luke's account, in the 11th chapter, if you'll turn back just a little bit, to Luke, the 11th chapter, and read with me beginning in verse 53 it is. Luke chapter 11, verse 53 beginning. It says, And when he was come out from thence, the scribes and Pharisees began to press upon him vehemently and to provoke him to speak of many things, laying wait for him to catch something out of his mouth. What are they trying to do? Trying to provoke him, trying to get him upset so he'll say something that they can accuse him of. Turn back, if you will, to Matthew 22. In Matthew's account, in Matthew 22, you'll read beginning in verse 15, then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might ensnare him in his talk. And they sent unto him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that thou art true and teachest the way of God in truth, and carest not for any one, for thou regardest not the persons of men. Tell us therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Now, are they interested in whether or not they ought to be paying their taxes? Well, they don't care about that. They've asked him a question. They think that they have him trapped. Either way he answers, he's in trouble. And that's why they've asked this question. Look at verse 23. On that day there came to him Sadducees, they that say that there is no resurrection. And they asked him, saying, Teacher, Moses said, If a man die, having no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. Now, we studied that just a few moments ago, or looked at it in Deuteronomy chapter 25. And that's so. Now, their question is, and the resurrection, whose wife shall she be? For they all had her. Notice Jesus' response. Jesus answered them and said, You know not the Scriptures, and you don't know the power of God. Verse 29. In the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as angels in heaven. But as touching the resurrection of the dead, have ye not read that which was spoken unto you by God, saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob? God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And when the multitude heard it, they were astonished at his teaching. Now, the quotation that Jesus gives is from the book of Exodus. Familiar passage to them should be chapter 3, verse 6. Now, in their questioning, did they have any reason to ask him a question about the resurrection? Were they having any interest in the resurrection? Those Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection, you see. Don't care about that. So why did they ask this question? Testing. Well, he put them to silence. I think, Brenda, if you're listening carefully, maybe it was you, I think it was, back several months ago when we were doing our studies from Zoom at home, all of us, on Wednesday night, you'd made the comment, or I've made the comment, that Jesus often gave answers that just absolutely silenced the people. The folks that were asking the question had nothing more to say. And I've often wished that perhaps I could give the appropriate answer at the appropriate time, because I've got 20/20 hindsight. Give me 2 or 3 weeks, 4 or 5 months, and boy, I've got a great answer. But on the spot, at the moment, I can't come up with the answer that I need like Jesus did to silence those people. And Brenda, I believe it was you that commented that Jesus had an eternity to think that thing through. Well, yeah, that's true. And often we don't. It's just right on the spur of the moment that we're trying to put it together. But look at what Jesus did to these fellows. Folks who prided themselves in their knowledge of the law and their knowledge of the power of God. And Jesus said, you don't even know the law. You don't know the scriptures, nor do you know the power of God. And he's answered their contention about the resurrection, showing them from a very familiar passage that indeed Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob still live somewhere. Now, regarding their question, in the resurrection, marriage don't exist. It don't exist. And you talk to some of your denominational friends, and they think that, or cultic friends, and they think, well, if I'm married in the temple in Salt Lake, then I'll be married throughout eternity to this person. No, you won't. You won't. Jesus said that's not so. He said in the resurrection, there's no such relationship as marriage. You remember in the beginning, when the marriage relationship was instituted, God said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and what will they become? One flesh. I want to underscore that word, flesh. They become one flesh. What does that tell us about the marriage relationship? It's a fleshly relationship. You get on the other side of this life, there's no such thing as marriage, and that's what you see in Matthew 22. You don't know God, and you don't know the Scriptures. Well, obviously they didn't know the Scriptures, so they would have been familiar with Genesis 2:24. They would have been familiar with Exodus 3, and so forth, verse 6. But they didn't know. Now, having considered that, verse 34 of Matthew 23. But the Pharisees, when they heard that he had put the Sadducees to silence, gathered themselves together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, trying him, Teacher, what's the great commandment of the law? And Jesus answered, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. The second is likened to it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments, the whole law hangeth and the prophets. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? We studied about that in Luke chapter 10 when the lawyer asked Jesus a similar question, and Jesus answered him, What saith the Scriptures? And that man correctly cited this text from the Old Testament that from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, that the commandment is, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and mind. And the second is likened to it, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And that's where then the Good Samaritan illustration comes in. And Jesus wanted to know who showed himself neighbor. Well, the man could not promptly respond, The Samaritan. He simply said, He that showed mercy. Well, indeed, what we want to see in this passage is that the Pharisees have tried in verse 15, the Sadducees have tried in verse 23, and now the Pharisees, they're going to make another stab at it. And then you'll note, beginning in verse 41, Jesus got a question for them. You see, the whole purpose of this chapter is to ensnare Jesus. They're watching him to try to find something in his speech that they can accuse him of. But in verse 41 of Matthew 23, it says, Now while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question, saying, What think ye of the Christ? Whose son is he? And they said, The son of David. And he said unto them, how then did David in the Spirit call him Lord, saying, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand till I make thine enemies the footstool, or put thine enemies under thy feet. If David then calleth him Lord, how is he his son? Well, they couldn't answer. They couldn't answer. Now, do you see multiple times the Pharisees and the Sadducees and those of the leadership of the Jews, they were laying in wait trying to trap Jesus in something that he's doing or saying so that they can accuse him. That's their only purpose in asking these questions. It's not for information. Frankly, I kind of resent somebody asking a question when the purpose of the question is not to seek information. The very purpose of the question is to start an argument. You ever known anybody like that? Can't be happy unless they're arguing about something. So I'm going to ask you something just to engage the argument. Not concerned about the answer to it. Whatever you say, I'm going to take issue with it because I like to argue. No, I don't like to argue, just so you know. And sometimes folks introduce something by saying, I'm playing the devil's advocate. Well, let me know that. If we're playing, then I'll play for a while. But I don't like somebody playing the devil's advocate while all the while they're trying to convince me that that's what they believe. And they just want to see what I'll say. I despise that. I don't like it at all, and certainly the Lord didn't like it, as you see in these texts. But they were watching. Now this word that's translated watching is an interesting word. That's not just simply they were viewing him. The idea is they were laying in wait. What we've seen them be doing in Matthew 22 and these other passages, that's all they're doing. Trying to find some occasion whereby they might accuse him. Now, notice in this text, going back to the text, in verse 2, it said, and behold, there was before him a certain man that had dropsy. Well, we need to identify what's wrong with the man. That's a word we don't use much anymore. But it's a problem that we're familiar with. I'll speak firsthand. I'm familiar with it. What is dropsy? Lynn? It's swelling. That's right. It's your body retaining fluid. And what happens when your body retains fluid? You swell up. That's what happens. That's what this man had. His body was retaining fluid. You ever see somebody whose feet and legs were so badly swollen you wonder how they walked? That's dropsy. That's what that is. Now when Jesus saw this man, verse 3 says that he answered and spake unto the lawyers. Let me ask you something. Betty Jo, how did Jesus know to answer them? They hadn't said anything. He's at this feast, and in comes this man that's all swollen, and the text says that Jesus answered them. They hadn't said anything. Does Jesus know why he's there? They're watching him. They want to see what he's going to do. Now, some have supposed, and I know we sometimes get in trouble by supposing, but I don't know if this man was there just incidentally, if this man was there to get the attention of Jesus, or if this man was there as a plant so that these who've invited Jesus to come might see what he would do. But before any of that gets out of the chute, Jesus answered them. They've not said anything. Don't you wish you could do that sometimes? Jesus answered them. They've not said anything yet. And his question then is to them, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day or not? But they held their peace. Is that the first time we've seen them doing that? No, no. No, Jesus knew how to put them to silence. See, they couldn't even say anything. He's there for them to accuse him. He knows that. They know that. In walks this man that needs healing. And Jesus answered them, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Now that's kind of a yes or no question, isn't it? But see, here's the problem. When you're posed with a yes or no answer to a question, and neither one of those is a good answer, you keep your mouth shut. And that's what they did. You see, if they responded, yes, it's lawful to heal on the Sabbath, then what's happened with the numerous accusations that they've lodged against him in the past? Out? Well, we've seen that multiple times. He healed on the Sabbath day, and all they saw was the day that it was. They didn't see that here's somebody that's been afflicted all of their life. Here in the previous chapter, we've talked about a woman that had an infirmity all bent up for 18 years. And all they could see was that Jesus made her whole on the Sabbath day, and they fussed and fumed about it. So now in the 14th chapter, before anybody has an opportunity to say anything, Jesus asked them a question. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? And they didn't say. If they'd said yes, then all the criticisms prior to this are out the door. Any future criticisms are out the door. So why don't they just say no? No, it's not lawful. Well, why couldn't they say that?
It's living in a bad light.
Yes, it does, but why?
Because that there's somebody there that is afflicted and in need.
Yes.
And this is in the public to say you're not worthy of being healed.
Yeah. So we got a problem either way they go with that. If you back up to the previous chapter, this woman that had been all bowed over for 18 years, in verse 15, Jesus said to them, "Ye hypocrites, doth not each of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his ass from the stall and leadeth them away to watering?" Now, watering an animal, would you consider that what we might call a humane act to do? Well, looking at this text, if you'll note in verse 5, Luke 14, verse 5, he said unto them, "Which of you shall have an ox or an ass or an ox fallen into a well and will not straightway draw him up on the Sabbath day?" They couldn't answer. Now, their opposition to Jesus healing on the Sabbath day, what did they equate that with? That's work. You're working on the Sabbath day. While at the same time, the law made provision for acts of kindness, humane acts, if you please. It made provision to get your ox out of the ditch or out of the well on the Sabbath day.
Another way to look at it, well, it's a humane act. It's good business. That's a selfish act, protecting your assets as well. So that's why I think they would allow it.
Well, yeah.
I like it,
yeah.
So I can
yeah.
do that.
Yeah, I can do that. That makes money. That puts money in my pocket. Randy?
The other thing about that question in verse 3, Jesus said, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" Well, he was the only one in the room who could do that.
Yeah.
They couldn't heal.
Yeah.
It's not like they had a choice. They're like, "Well, you know, we could. If we want to on Sabbath,
yeah, yeah.
We can't heal anything."
No, no. But they're already endorsing the practice of engaging in humane acts, getting the ox out of the ditch or getting the animal water on the Sabbath day. They'd already endorsed that. So they're already over the line on their accusation that this is not lawful. So they can't say that to Jesus. Or they put themselves in violation of their very own law. You see. So here we got a problem. So they said, we just don't know. We don't know. No, they didn't say that. They didn't know. They didn't know. They didn't want to answer. I think they knew. They didn't want to answer. The text tells us that they held their peace. He took him and healed him and let him go. You see, if they declared that it's lawful, then they've defeated this plot that they've had by inviting him here.
The other thing I was thinking was the paralytic that was healed in Matthew 9. When they brought him in and he said, "Your sins are forgiven." And then it says in verse 4, Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, "Why are you thinking evil in your hearts?" This is the case where he knew their thoughts.
Yeah.
So when it says he answered them, he was answering their thoughts.
That's what he was answering, just exactly. He knew why he was there. He knew what they were going to do. He knew the way that they were thinking and planning for. This was not the first time. We saw it in Luke chapter 13. And you're right. When you look back there in Matthew, he knew that too. "And so that you might know that I have the authority to forgive sins." Then he said to the palsied man, "Take up your bed and walk." He proved who he was, what authority that he had. So these people, they held their peace. There's nothing more for them to say. Just as you read in Matthew 22 and again in Matthew chapter, 22, several instances there in that chapter. Now, lest somebody come up with a notion about the words that are used in the American Standard Translation. Which of you shall say to his ox or his ass fallen into the well? Now, I understand that there were numerous wells in the part of the country. It's just a pit, and animals could fall in. But they'd get him out. Some have said, well, there's some question concerning the objects of the benevolent help. The textual evidence, specific ancient manuscripts identified by this man, favors a son or an ox over the translation which reads an ass or an ox. I put that up there simply for information's sake. I really don't care. Because the point is, you do this. If it was your son, if it was an animal who fell into a hole, you'd get him out. End of story. Nothing more need to be said on that. So these humane acts were something that the law provided for. Here's the passages. You can read them. Exodus 23, Deuteronomy 22. These are the kind of things that were permitted by the law. So their accusation about healing somebody that is all swollen up from their body retaining fluids is just full of holes. Now, what's going to happen to you, inevitably, if you're not healed? Sometimes we call that congestive heart failure. You know, when your body starts swelling up around your ankles, swelling up in your calves, and then swelling up into your thighs, you know where else water is being retained? Yes, in your lungs, in your stomach cavity, around your heart. What's going to happen to you? You're going to die. So Jesus' question is a very real one. Is it lawful for me to save this man's life, to heal on the Sabbath day or not? Now, you'll get an ox out of the ditch. You'll pull your son up out of a hole. But you want me to stand here and let this man die because it's the Sabbath day? Such foolishness. Now, when you're looking for something, that's what you find. That's just what you find. In verse 4 or verse 7 beginning, we see the beginning of some parables that Jesus speaks to them. In verse 7 it says, He spake a parable unto them that were bidden. When he marked how they chose out the chief seats, saying unto them, When thou art bidden of any man to a marriage feast, sit not down in the chief seat, lest haply a more honorable man than thou be bidden of him. And he that bade thee and him shall come and say to thee, Give this man place. And then thou shalt begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when thou art bidden, go and sit down in the lowest place, that when he that hath bidden thee cometh, he may say to thee, Friend, go up higher. Then thou shalt have glory in the presence of all that sit at meat with thee. For everyone that exalteth himself shall be humbled, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. Let me suggest to you that there are three lessons in these parables. The first of which is a lesson on pride. Now, you've seen this. Many of you have been to formal gatherings for a bride and her new husband. We call it the reception after the wedding, okay? Some have a feast on the night of the rehearsal dinner. Call it the rehearsal dinner. And what happens? Well, generally, most places that I've been, and you have too, they have tables that go up like this and then a table that goes across the front. And the people that are serving at these feasts, the open end of the what we'll call the U shape is where the servers go in and out, right? You've been there and done that. Who generally sits up here at this table across the front? The bride and groom. Who else generally sits up there? We've all been there. Who sits there? Aren't the wedding party, people that are important, the father of the bride, the mother of the bride, and the groom, they sometimes sit up there, the best man, the people that are important sit up there, right? Okay? If you're just somebody that walked in off the street, they'd probably ask you to leave. But let's just suppose you're somebody that walked in off the street and you take your seat right beside the bride. I guarantee you, you'll be asked to leave. Okay? That's a simple illustration. That's what Jesus is telling them. They were familiar with these great marriage feasts. We've just talked about the marriage feast in our Sunday morning Bible class of the study of the book of Revelation. Now that sometimes the marriage feast may have lasted several days. But here you have positions of honor that are reserved for the wedding party, if you please. Important people. And if you just go in and take that, that's called a chief seat, then why in the world would you do that? What are you thinking about yourself if you go in and sit down beside the bride and you don't know her from Adam? Who are you? You think you deserve that seat? But you see, if you go in and maybe she knows you and you take a lesser seat and she says, I want you to come up here and sit with us. Now you're honored. But if you presume that's your place and you're asked to take a lower seat and yield to somebody else, now you're dishonored. So Jesus is teaching a very simple, very valuable lesson on humility. Now, that's the case. Why was that so important? Well, who's he talking with? Look at the occasion. One of the rulers of the Pharisees on the Sabbath day has invited all these people to come and eat bread. Chapter 14, verse 1. In verse 7, he spake the parable unto those that were bidden. This is the guest list, folks, here. He's talking to the people that have been invited by this big important ruler of the Jews. There are places of honor, there are places of dishonor. You go in, you take a lower seat, then you're asked to go up, you're better. Okay? You go in and take the upper seat, you ask to take a lower seat, now you're humbled. I want to suggest to you that humility is a must. Even among those who were the closest to the Lord had problems with this. You recall the mother of James and John came. She wanted, when you come in your kingdom, can I have one of my sons set on your right hand and one on the left? And when the other disciples heard about that, they were very upset because those were positions they wanted. You see, they're not upset with James and John for asking. They wanted that too. And so there was envy and jealousy even among the disciples over who's going to have what place. And that was a constant with the apostles. And so here's the lesson. We'll have to come back to this a bit next time. And very important point, I think, that we need to see.